for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
David Andrews is the author of Why Does the Other Line Always Move Faster?
Thanks to the people who are generous with their time as they help us produce the show, Gary Niederhoff, Barbara Bantz, and thanks to VoiceWork and Q Consultation from Emma Bentley.
Thanks also to financial support from Rena Shulsky David and Sammy David, and to the William K. Bowes Jr. Foundation. Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute, a nonprofit science and education organization whose researchers study the origin and nature of life, including scanning the skies with its Allen Telescope Array. And a big thanks also to our listeners.
Your ears have been attuned to the Big Picture Science episode, Time Travel Agents. If you'd like to hear more Big Picture Science, well, you'll find episodes in our archive at bigpicturescience.org.
And if you're a podcast listener but prefer listening to over-the-air radio because the shows zip by you at the speed of light.
Is that true?
It is. Check out the listing on our website. You hadn't noticed. Check out the listing on our website of radio stations that carry the program. And if your local station is not on that list, consider letting them know you like the show.
You're back.
Yeah, I figured I ought to pick up a Big Ben t-shirt for my kid. Any idea where I can get one?
The Houses of Parliament gift shop, of course, but it's just about to close. Oh, yeah. Never mind.
All right, thanks. See ya.
Cheerio.
And you too can be dancing with Daddy G every Tuesday afternoon from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Malt Shop, right here on WHFR.FM. The jukebox will be spinning the platters from the 50s and the 60s. So hang those fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror, grab your favorite squeeze, and join me, Daddy G, at the Malt Shop on Tuesdays from 2 to 4 p.m. Be there! Or be square.
Arr, how are you, me hearties? This be WHFR Dearborn. This be the station that be making waves, and you can take that from Pierre Lafitte the pirate. Arr.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. Hi, I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.FM is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And our guest today is the Honorable Mr. Paul Hellyer. Mr. Hellyer was the former Minister of Defense for Canada in the 1960s. He served in three governments for a total of 23 and a half years in Parliament. Mr. Hellyer was the first person of cabinet rank to make the statement, UFOs, and I quote, UFOs are as real as the airplanes overhead. And he has written several books, mostly of a political and financial nature. However, his latest being Light at the End of the Tunnel, a survival plan for the human species. Dealing with UFOs and extraterrestrial species. So he has been interviewed on numerous radio and TV shows over the years on his knowledge of politics and finance, as well as on his knowledge of the UFO phenomenon. So it is my honor to welcome to the show Mr. Paul Hellyer. Hello, Mr. Hellyer.
Good evening, David.
How are
you?
Nice
to be with you.
It's good to have you on. In fact, it's an honor.
I could make one small correction. The light at the end of the tunnel, the survival plan for the human species, is my second last book. The latest one is The Money Mafia, A World in Crisis.
Ah, okay.
It's there are similar themes. They fit together, but the just to let the public know that the latest one is The Money Mafia, A World in Crisis.
Very good. But the one dealing with UFOs is the one I mentioned, correct?
Well, it has less in about UFOs than the latest one.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, they both have something in them about it. But the latest one goes further and deeper into the subject than Light at the End of the Tunnel.
Very good. And state that title again.
The title is The Money Mafia, A World in Crisis.
Aha. Very good. So, while you were Minister of Defense in Canada, were you introduced to the UFO phenomenon through sighting reports?
Right. That's about the only thing I knew about it at the time. These were regularly put on my desk by the Air Force, who kept records of sightings that were reported. Mm-hmm. And I think the ratio, if I remember correctly, is roughly 80% of all of the sightings were natural phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
They were things that they could recognize as being Uranus or a comet or something of one kind or another,
mm-hmm.
and 20% were not identified, so they qualify as an unidentified flying object. And I think it's interesting that this is just about the same proportion that they had in the United Kingdom, as I recall from talking with the head of the department over there.
And the United States as well.
Yeah, they would all be similar, I think.
Yeah. So what did you make of those reports at the time?
Well, I didn't have much time to look at them because I was busy unifying the Canadian Armed Forces,
mm-hmm.
the Canadian Navy, the Canadian Army, and the Royal Canadian Air Force into a single Canadian Defense Force. And this was almost like a war of a kind. If anybody wants to try it, they would know just how difficult it is.
No, thank you.
and it took all of my energies, so that I was on that front line nearly all of the time and really didn't have much time for UFOs and didn't really have much interest in them because there were so many more urgent things on my desk at that particular time for the 6 years that I was in the Defense Department. Mm.
Or at least the urgency was kind of muted by the powers that be, is that right?
You're absolutely right. The powers that be, as they are called, didn't tell the minister everything that was going on, I'm sure, because there were early signs that Canada was involved. We had a scientist by the name of Wilbert Smith.
Oh, yeah.
In the Department of Transport, which I later became minister of before I left politics. And he was in the business very early on. And he had read a couple of books that had come across his table, and he managed to get some information from the embassy in the United States as to what was going on down there. And he wrote a top-secret memo very early on saying that that UFOs were real, that they were the most highly classified thing in the United States, even above the H-bomb, that the United States government was very concerned about them, and that a group had been set up under Dr. Vannevar Bush to try and figure out the method of propulsion and other things about the vehicles so that they would know more about them and perhaps in due course back engineer them.
So, Bush, that was during the time of the Majestic 12, as they call it.
Yes, he was a member of the original MJ-12, I think, as I recall.
There was a period of time where the government, at least our government, I guess, denied that MJ-12 was a real entity.
And they still don't go around advertising it, do they?
No. Well, there was a time when they said that Area 51 didn't exist.
They've denied everything.
Yeah.
And since 1947, when the two crashes occurred in Roswell, and have made a business of it. The original finding of one of the vehicles in Roswell, as you don't know, was reported as a saucer by the commanding officer of the Army Air Corps base there. Then just 3 or 4 hours later, his boss, Brigadier General Robert Roger Ramey, put out a press release saying, no, that wasn't true. It wasn't a flying saucer. It was a Rawan balloon, meteorological balloon. And that was the story that was picked up by the Eastern Press, the New York Times and the Washington Post and so on, and it became the truth, quote unquote, for 60 years or more. Until a lot of us began saying, "Hey, this is one of the big lie," and it was the first of a series of lies. It became the foundation of a cult of lying. About this subject that has really persisted right through until the present time.
Right, that's right. But back then, it was so secret, UFOs were so secret, that the head of 509th didn't know it was secret. And when it happened, they said, well, I guess it's true. And then he gets a phone call and says, no, we will not discuss that. Am I correct?
Well, that was the party line, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was trying to think of something that had been the truth the other day, because I have been saying that starting in 1947, the U.S. government has seldom, if ever, told the truth about anything of significance. And there was one flight of UFOs over Washington back in the 1950s.
52,
That was reported in the local press. And this is the one that allegedly got Shirley MacLaine interested in the subject, or so she told me. And it was later one of the senior Army Air Corps officers said that they had seen them, and they did not know whose they were, but they were not ours, quote-unquote, something like that. And I think that's just about the last time since 1947 that anybody has even said that much. And that shows you how deeply embedded this whole business of secrecy and conspiracy and so on is interwoven in our culture. And has been for so long that people just kind of accept it as being part of the show, and it's a very dangerous part, because the people have a right to know what's going on. That's what I said when I went public 12 years ago, and especially when they're paying for it and don't know it. And, they've paid trillions of dollars for back engineering, and nobody has ever told them. And they get money from Congress by means of setting up dummy companies and projects and so on, and then diverting it to the space program. And this has been going on for years, and with Congress really not having a clue of what the situation was.
No, they don't. They really don't want to know, in my opinion.
Well, maybe they don't. As a matter of fact, I had a call yesterday from a researcher for the Armed Forces Committee, and he certainly gave the impression that they had been told very little. Mm-hmm. And he wanted quite a bit of information from me, and I, of course, recommended my latest book as being a good source, and then we could start from there, and we could go into it a little more deeply.
Right. That's a good idea. Good. Hey, let them get a little background first, huh?
Right.
Okay, so I was about to ask if you've gotten any pushback from any government agencies since you've come out with your beliefs and knowledge.
They tried to get in touch with me very early on.
Who's they?
The CIA.
Okay.
When I went to Hawaii soon after going public, and I made a keynote speech down there, even though I knew less about ufology than anybody else in the room.
Mm-hmm.
But that isn't my business. I'm a politician,
and
know a little bit about the armed forces and how they work and so on. So that I talked about the things that I know, not the things that professional ufologists know.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a call came through from that everybody recognized, not everybody, but the people that were with me came from Langley, and somehow they managed to make sure they never got through to me.
Hmm.
And there have been a few efforts, and I think the only maybe other thing is that there was a piece in the Washington Post a few years ago, I can't remember how many, two or three or four, quoting me as saying that the United States was run by Nazis.
What?
And I had not said that. I never said it. I never mentioned the word.
Yeah.
But I did have the word in my book that I just mentioned to you.
Uh-huh.
And it was proof positive that they had been monitoring what I was writing.
Ah.
And somebody, they seem to know who it was in the CIA, had leaked this story.
Yeah.
And we could not get a retraction from the Post, even though I denied saying it. They just refused to retract, and that's how deeply they are in bed, I think, with the intelligence community.
So anybody that's coming for anybody with high profile like yourself comes forward with the truth about UFOs and positive feedback about UFOs, it seems like they try to discredit them. Is that right?
Absolutely, yes. I had somebody follow me around for the first, year or so,
mm-hmm.
everywhere I went to speak, Colonel John Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
And he was what we would say was on the other side. And the
side of what?
Of the truth argument.
I see. Okay.
And he first of all, he said that that UFOs were just a hoax, that they didn't exist.
Chinese hoax? Is that what it is?
I don't know. Some kind of a hoax. Anyway, and then it got to the point where when he said that, people would laugh at him.
Mm-hmm.
So he changed his story and said, they actually did exist, but the United States government wasn't really interested in them. And that was, I think, almost equal as a lie to the first one.
Well, yeah, it's a lie, but it's an admission they exist, whether government's interested or not.
Well, absolutely. He couldn't get around the fact that they existed because he was in a room full of people where 97% of them knew that they actually did exist and wouldn't think he was just a little bit off.
Well, there's another way, another lie that they used to tell when they had a mass sighting, okay? And it wasn't just Joe blow out in his field, you know, noticing a light in the sky, but a mass sighting of these UFOs, and or a UFO, and the government would come out with, oh, that was a prototype, a secret prototype, that was one of ours, and they said, well, fine, just fly that over again, let us know, give us a date, a place, a time, and do a flyover again. And then we'll know it was just a prototype.
It was just a prototype, yeah.
And, well, we can't do that. Well, why not? It was the same way with the Phoenix lights.
Right.
Fly them over again. Well, we can't do that. It's a prototype. It's secret. What are you talking about? You just flew it from northern Arizona to southern Arizona.
Right.
Do it again.
Oh, the Phoenix lights were and still are a matter of very great interest, and just where they came from, we'd love to know.
Really, really. I need to take one moment just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, 89.3 FM. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with former Minister of Defense for Canada, the Honorable Mr. Paul Hellyer. I was going to ask something here. What was? Oh yeah. What happened to finally pique your interest in the UFO subject?
It was a fairly long story, but 12 years ago, in 2005. Well, it started a little before that.
Mm-hmm.
There was a young bilingual man from Ottawa, Ontario, from our capital, and he started sending me reports about UFOs, and I was honest with him. I said, Pierre, I haven't got time to read this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, that's okay. Just put it on a shelf until you do have time, that proverbial rainy day.
Right.
So, well, I said, well, that's fair enough if you're willing to go along with that. And a couple of more things. He sent me a book called The Day After Roswell. And I looked at it, and I said, oh, to myself, that would be an interesting read. I'll keep that and make it my reading for next summer at our little place in Muskoka, Ontario, which is about 120 miles north of Toronto in the Lake Country.
Mm-hmm.
That's about the only time except Christmas when I have enough time to sit down and read two or three books and enjoy them. So I put it on my list, and then when I went to look for it, I guess it was maybe in 2004, I couldn't find it, and so I read The Life of Pi instead, which was very entertaining.
Yeah.
And I didn't really, I admit I didn't really know until I got near the end whether it was truth or fiction.
Yeah.
And then the following year, I was looking for another book, and couldn't find it, but there, right staring me in the face, was The Day After Roswell. So I decided to take that with me. In the meantime, Pierre had persuaded me to watch an ABC special put together by Peter Jennings, who happened to be a producer who was born in Ottawa, where he was, where Pierre was. And I can't remember whether it was 2 or 3 hours long, but it was quite long. And they had a whole array of former Air Force pilots, commercial pilots, and policemen, and aircraft controllers, and they all had seen UFOs. And I said to myself, well, you know, why would those chaps lie? I mean, what advantage is there for them to go on this program and tell lies?
All right.
And so I thought right at the time, hey, that's something I should tuck away in the recesses of my mind. Then in 2005, I took The Day After Roswell, written by Colonel Philip Corso, to our little place, Arundel Lodge, north of Toronto, and started to read it. My nephew, Philip, came along and said, what are you reading? And I told him, and he said, well, I'm a skeptic. I said, well, it's still a free country, more or less. You're getting less all the time. And you're entitled to be a skeptic. 2 days later, he went home, and 2 days later, he phoned me and said, I talked to the general, and he said, every word is true and more.
Huh.
Well, the general was a retired United States Air Force general who was then in the aircraft business, and that's where Philip met him. And actually, I had met him on one occasion, too. And he said, where can I get a copy of the book? And I told him. Huh. In the meantime, just before I went up there, I was invited to speak to a symposium on extraterrestrials and exopolitics at the University of Toronto by two Canadian ufologists, Victor Vigiani and Mike Bird. And one of my weaknesses is procrastination. And so I hadn't got back to them and say, well, no, because I'm not a ufologist and I don't know anything about the subject. And after reading the book, I said to myself, hey, I've got to go public, because I recognize the truthfulness of the book from the names of the generals and the airports that were listed in the book, because I knew them both from my days in national defense. So I said, this is truth, not fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So I had two things holding me back. One was I was getting married a week to the day after the symposium.
Mm-hmm.
My wife of 59 years had died the previous year.
Mm-hmm.
And the widow of my best friend was still around, and we had been a foursome. The four of us used to work together, pray together, take holidays together, and travel together, and so on. So I asked her if she would marry me, and she said yes.
Mm-hmm.
And we were getting married on October the 1st, which was exactly a week after the symposium. So I phoned her and said, told her what the score was, and she wasn't wildly enthusiastic, if I might be guilty of an understatement. But I said, well, it's just going to be a one-time thing, and I feel I have some responsibility to do this.
Mm.
I didn't really, when I said it, I didn't really think I was lying to her. But the way things turned out, I guess you could say that it certainly wasn't the way things turned out.
One thing led to another, eh?
Yeah, they sure did. So the other thing was to check with the general personally and hear it from his lips. So I got his number from Philip and told him to give him the general a heads up that I'd be calling.
Mm-hmm.
And when I did, before I could even say, hello, how are you, or, what's the weather like, he said, every word is true and more.
Hmm.
And then he went on to talk about the more for 20 minutes.
Right.
To the extent that he thought he could do or get away with it, and in view of his oath, of course. And the most interesting thing in the and more, as far as I was concerned, he said, there have been face-to-face meetings between the United States officials and visitors from other star systems.
Uh-huh.
So, with that, as verification for what I believe to be true, I phoned Vigiani and Bird and said that I would go on their program. I did, and you have already given the quote. At the end of my short speech, I said that UFOs are as real as the airplanes flying overhead.
Now,
no maybe or no reservations, just they are.
All right.
That is the truth, and that's the truth that the people should know.
Now, when he said that there had been official meetings between U.S. officials and E.T., was he alluding to the Eisenhower
alleged Eisenhower meeting when he was supposed to be at the dentist?
He didn't give me any specifics.
Okay.
It was just the statement that there have been meetings, period.
Hmm.
And, of course, the Eisenhower meeting, were, I guess there were maybe two of them, are things that came to me later when I was doing my research into the subject. But, of course, once I had went public, then instead of it being a one-off thing, I started getting information from all over the world, documents, some classified, some unclassified. And if you have to get to know the separate the wheat from the chaff, which doesn't take me long, being an old farm boy. And books. I can't remember exactly how many books I got, but a lot of them, probably more than 20. I read every one of them. And people started getting in touch with me. One of my first briefing was Dr. Stephen Greer. He was coming to Toronto to make a speech, so he wanted to see me, and we had lunch on the boardwalk, just, you know, about 100 yards or 200 yards from where I live. And he gave me a three-hour briefing, including a rundown of just how secret the whole thing was and how he was briefing potential presidents and heads of intelligence units that didn't have a clue what the score was. And so that was the beginning, and then I've since had briefings by many, many ufologists, some of the best in the world, and continue to do research. And then I also started to do some of my own research in following up stories like the one in the Rendlesham Forest case in Britain,
right,
which is one of the most popular and one of the most
well documented, yeah,
of all the stories. And I was given a document that was public on that score. And so I was in Washington for the National Prayer Breakfast, I guess probably 2006. And I had got in touch with Colonel Holt, and he was reluctant to talk to me, but then when I told him who had given me his name, he said, well, with his recommendation, I'll see you. So I went down and we had lunch, and he talked for, I think it was 2 hours. I tape recorded the whole thing, and then I put a chunk of it in the book, as you apparently know, The Light at the End of the Tunnel, because it was so typical of the way the system works. Somebody reports a sighting, and then everybody else says you're crazy, you know, or it's just your imagination. And he went through that, and he was typical. And it was only, I think, Christmas Eve or Christmas night when they were having a banquet for the star performers on the two bases, that his boss, when another report came in, said, well, I have to continue making these presentations. You go out and find out what's going on, which he did, and got his little posse to go out and look. And he, by in his own words, when he said, when he was sent out, his attitude was, I'm going out to put an end to this nonsense once and for all.
Right.
Quote. And instead, what he saw changed his life forever.
Yeah.
And now, as you probably know, he's written a huge book on it.
Yeah.
And has been doing the circuit of people who are truthers, as we call them. And afterwards, of course, he went through all this business of disappearing documents and talking to people who had seen something and they wouldn't talk. You know, they just pretended it hadn't happened.
Mm-hmm.
So that story was fascinating and deep.
Who tried to get a hold of people that denied it? Holt? Is that what you're talking about?
denied that this had happened?
Yeah.
Yeah, he tried to get some documents.
From whom?
And they had disappeared.
Oh, okay.
So, and these were documents that he knew about or in some cases had seen.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, where are they? They're nowhere.
Well, you must know. I mean, I don't have to tell you. Number one, I've been in the U.S. Army, and you have been in politics, and I don't have to tell you that governments keep documentation forever, virtually. But it seems like documents related to Rendlesham Forest, Roswell, the likes, seem to vanish into thin air. Am I right? Am I right, sir?
They seem to. I don't think they do.
No, they don't vanish. But no, you can't get a hold
of
them.
They're just put in somebody's vault. And if my informants are right, probably back in Eisenhower's day, one of the Rockefellers, Nelson Rockefeller,
mm-hmm.
Eisenhower had designated to handle the file,
mm-hmm.
set it up in such a way that that industry sort of took over possession of most of the file, and so a lot of the documents have been secured by industry,
mm-hmm.
so that when somebody goes to the Air Force or they go through to the old Army Air Corps and so on and ask for something, they have deniability. They just say, we don't have them.
Right, right.
That doesn't mean they don't exist. They just say that...
They don't have them.
They don't have them.
Yeah. Or...
Consequently, they can't produce them if they haven't got them. And this, of course, has been the one of the keys that they have had ever since in hiding stuff from people and...
Right. Or I cannot confirm nor deny.
Yeah, right. Well, that's the next step. That's less... That's less absolute than the
I can't confirm it because it's the truth. I can't deny it. I can't confirm it because it's a secret. I can't deny it because it's the truth.
Right.
Yeah. So you were you had participated in May 2nd, 2013 citizens hearing on disclosure.
Right.
Tell us about that experience.
Well, it was very interesting. Just before that, I had made my first 100% speech on UFOs,
mm-hmm.
at a symposium put together by Paula Harris,
mm-hmm.
in Florida. She was she was supposed to be at a speaker at the meeting where I went public, and she was ill.
Hmm.
But she flew from all the way from Italy.
Italy, yeah.
To interview me, and she still has some of that stuff, and she's still using it because it was pretty good stuff that she did. Anyway, I went from there to Washington for Steve Bassett's disclosure meeting, and absolutely fascinating. We had these, I think it was six, wasn't it, former members of Congress and the Senate,
mm-hmm.
All of whom agreed to go and pretend that they were a congressional committee and took evidence under oath. And there wasn't a single one of them at the outset who knew that UFOs were real.
Hmm.
Not one out of the six. Now, these are people who had been in Congress for some time,
mm-hmm.
and had obviously been... some of the people that had voted money for these back engineering, the black ops, as they're called, and didn't even know it. So we started out, and we took oaths, as you would, before a real congressional committee.
Right.
And we started out, and there were 40 of us. And we went through the gamut. There were former Air Force people there, and air traffic controllers, and pilots, and so on. And some of the 40s spoke two or three times during the course of the hearings, but one by one they were convinced, and Rendlesham Forest case was one of the ones that nailed down one or two people at least, because it was so well documented. They just, you know, they couldn't resist the compelling nature of the evidence.
All right.
So they had to go for it. And one of the people who gave evidence was a former Air Force colonel. I think his name might have been Scott. I can't be absolutely sure. And when he gave a short speech, but he said his job was that whenever a sighting was reported to the press and they phoned the Air Force for verification, his job to say, no, it wasn't a UFO, it was swamp gas.
Love it. I love it.
and the American the American taxpayers were paying this guy's salary first, and now then his pension for kidding them.
Kind of makes you want to ask for a refund, doesn't it?
It does, you know. And but the refund would be so big.
Oh my God!
The national debt would go even further.
I have to take one more minute just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And I'm David Twitchell. This is We Are Not Alone, and we're speaking with the Honorable Mr. Paul Hellyer. And one other thing, you had mentioned something about the deathbed confession of the chief of emergency measures in Ottawa. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, you know, this was a case that was very real. I have a friend, as a matter of fact, got a cruise list in the mail from him yesterday, Ray Stone, who had been in the Royal Canadian Air Force and later in the Armed Forces in publicity. And he had talked to this person who was sick and was willing to talk. Mm-hmm. And he sent me something on it and said, hey, this is interesting stuff. And so I made an appointment to see them, the chap. And then, as I say in the book, I think before I was able to get down to see him, he became very ill. And Ray phoned and said, if you want to talk to him, you better give him a call right away. Mm-hmm. Which I did, and he confirmed what I had read that he had written, that he had been, he didn't say Langley, but I mean, obviously that's where it was, and the CIA was briefing him and thought that, they asked him if he would like to see a UFO, because they thought it might be useful for him in emergency measures to know some of the things that you should be careful of. These are vehicles that could do you harm if you start handling them and don't know what you're doing.
Right.
So he said, sure. And they flew him to somewhere in the West, quote unquote, and five guesses that it was Area 51. and they went in a bus where the windows were all black and all right. That sort of thing, you know. And then they wound up in a hangar where there were several UFOs, and he was taken inside of one and really had a good look at it, and then he reported you know, what it looked like and the fact that there was no stick, like or the same kind of controls that we have in normal conventional airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
and the whole thing, and he was trying to find out why this had crashed. I think he was told it was because of the pilots were like teenage drivers. They were just a little reckless. And and weren't careful enough in what they were doing. I have some doubts about that, but that's the story that that he was given. But he actually saw the real machine. It was not one that was made in the USA, and observed how it was made and all of the things that were different about it from normal airplanes. And so he had never told anybody, including his wife, because that was the undertaking that he'd given the CIA. Mm-hmm. But when he was on his deathbed, like a lot of other folks, he says, this information is something that I have to pass on before I go.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had written this thing, which I got, and also then talked to me on the phone. So it was about as authentic as you could get.
Yeah. From
somebody who was there and saw and all of the paraphernalia of what was going on.
Did he say what kind of controls there were? Like it was a panel that you place your hands on?
I think he mentioned, yeah, that it was you use your mind to control.
You use your mind to control.
Yeah, ship.
And
tell it to go up, down, sideways, stop.
And, you know, that sounds so Star Trek-y and beyond Star Trek, but we have computers now that you can control with your mind.
Yeah.
And so...
If you have a mind.
If you have a mind to control it. but what's stopping them? And there are cars, driverless cars.
Right.
What's stopping them in the future from putting these two together and controlling that computerized vehicle, with your mind?
You know? Well, probably nothing except time and money.
That's it. And an advanced civilization, I would say, has both.
Yeah, and
if they use money,
we're spending far too much money, in my opinion.
Oh, really?
Trying to make it too fast into space.
Yeah.
We have people starving in the world.
Yeah.
We have people with no clothes. We have people with no water.
Mm-hmm.
We have people with no housing. And one spaceship would be enough to supply most of them with their, you know, the things they need.
Yeah.
And we as a species, have our priorities all twisted, in my opinion.
I wonder how much money we could save, just America could save, if they took 1 year's allotment for keeping UFOs secret and putting it into food and clothing for people who don't have it.
It would be interesting to know, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would.
It would be fairly substantial.
Yeah. We need the bean counters to crunch the numbers on that, eh?
Yep. But just one piece of hardware would be enough to feed millions.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And it's, so we have to look at these kinds of priorities,
mm-hmm.
and we have to look at the motives of some of the people that have this technology,
mm-hmm.
and see if Dr. Greer is right, that what they're planning to do is to use it against us. And
who is planning to use it? E.T.?
No.
Who?
Our own people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're talking about the false flag or what?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Carol Rosen said that Wernher von Braun had told her that... in his deathbed confession, that there was going to be a false flag war with E.T., which was just to justify our space-based weapons.
Right.
Do you feel that's possible?
Yeah, I know Carol very well.
Mm-hmm.
And we have discussed these things on many occasions. I think she said, the story goes a little differently each time, but she said that he said they had to have an enemy.
Mm-hmm.
in order to justify ridiculous defense expenditures.
Right.
And he said, first it will be the communists. So that was like, you know, the Cold War and before.
Right.
And then he said it has to be the, would be the terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they didn't have enough terrorists, they manufactured some more by attacking Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And then he said, finally, it will be the ETs.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you noticed, there was a news release by the United States Air Force this last week that they were going to have to spend more money because they would be doing more fighting in space.
More fighting in space.
Yeah. And I thought to myself, this is just fulfillment of exactly what I was concerned about when I went public 12 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah,
and after chasing these visitors, first with planes that couldn't even keep up with them, They now have technology that is advanced enough and weapons that are advanced enough that they can get us in real trouble.
Oh, yeah.
And
I
wouldn't put it past them. That's something that I sort of think about once in a while.
You'd think they learn... You would think that they had learned from the shoot 'em down order given by Truman after we lost so many U.S. pilots.
Right.
And I don't know, probably did Canada lose pilots trying to shoot 'em down, so to speak?
I don't know. Uh-huh. I wouldn't be surprised. I do know that when I found out that quite a few planes were going down, that one of the things I learned was that some of them, at least, were because the pilots were getting too close to ETs.
Yeah.
And the radiation was having an effect on the molecular composition of the metal in mm-hmm. the airplanes.
Yeah.
And they disintegrated.
And the controls, huh?
Yeah. And just went out of control.
Yeah.
So that... often the ETs try to take measures to avoid, avoidance measures to mm-hmm. avoid that sort of problem, but then if people keep going after you, there are bound to be some accidents, and there were.
Accidents and self-defense measures. You
know? Oh, sure, yeah, both.
Yeah, yeah. And yet, I think we brought a few of them down, don't you think?
More recently, yes. They have weapons now that can do that,
uh-huh.
And this is the visitor's own technology.
Uh-huh.
Not maybe the theory might have gone back to Tesla and so on,
uh-huh.
But they have particle guns and things that will destroy just about anything.
Yeah, I doubt very much if their ET would use these weapons if we just leave them alone, you know?
I think you're right. I nearly all of them are benign, as far as I can find out.
Right.
I'm sure you've heard this, that when presidents are briefed and given the small amount of information that they're actually given,
uh-huh.
that they're told that nearly all of them are benign, with perhaps one exception or two exceptions.
Uh-huh.
So the majority are on our side, but they have, an agreement that they don't interfere unless they're asked.
Mm-hmm.
And we have apparently a couple of treaties with a couple of species, and so we haven't maybe taken advantage of the some of the species that would be more beneficial to us.
Yeah. Now, you had mentioned at the citizens' hearing on disclosure something about Mr. Charles Hall in connection with the tall white species.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
Well, yes. This was a story that that Paula Harris broke. Charles Hall was working in Area 51, and he was one of the few people who managed to get a personal relationship with one of the tall whites, I think, from rescuing the daughter of one of them
hmm.
when she got stuck in the sagebrush. And so instead of being frightened out of his wits, as most of the people who were working on the range there, he managed to get a working relationship, and I think he was in one of the scout ships, although I think one of the scout ships might have been made by the U.S.
Really?
It was hard to tell. But he was wound up in the hospital in one of the mountains where there were doctors, both tall whites and the United States Air Force, and they thought he was under the weather and couldn't see what was going on, but he managed to get a pretty good reading of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so he has written a book of two or three different variations. I think it was Millennial Hospitality.
Hmm.
And they're very interesting to hear what he did and his relationship and how fascinating it actually was and what they did and their ability to travel very quickly across the desert and jump over fences and all of that sort of thing.
Hmm.
And so it's quite an interesting little sidebar, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah,
but there are other, there are other considerations too. That, but I think it gives you a glimpse into the duplicity of the armed forces, the cabal, as I call them.
Mm-hmm.
Or, of course, the armed forces are just part of the cabal. Maybe I should explain that the cabal that I find worrisome is a huge non-organization headed by the banking cartel.
Mm-hmm.
And then the oil cartel, which is really to a very large extent controlled by the banking cartel, and then the transnational corporations who have direct links to the banking cartel. And then the intelligence organizations, a lot of them, but it's certainly including the CIA, the FBI, and the NSA, and MI6 in the UK, and the Mossad from Israel, and then a huge slice of the U.S. military. And they are the ones that are referred to as the alternate government or the shadow government.
Hmm.
And they have been running the United States for, 60 years, something like that.
Huh.
And they are the ones that have the knowledge, and they are the ones that have the plans that I think are worrisome as far as we're concerned, because what they have in mind is a government for a large part of the world, which is a totalitarian government of, by, and for them.
Yeah.
And not for us.
And they're the ones that would suffer if full disclosure came to be. Am I correct in saying that?
I don't know if they will suffer or if they'll just come out of the woodwork and exercise their plan.
Hmm.
And that's what I discuss to a considerable extent in my latest book.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know the answer to the question. They're a very, very powerful organization.
Yeah.
And they have this geoengineering capacity now where they can bring about earthquakes that look like real earthquakes.
Huh.
And they can make snow in the summer and rain in the winter and do all sorts of things, none of which are really, first of all, authorized by we the people.
Mm-hmm.
It's all secretive, but it gives them control to an extent that no one has ever had control in the history of the world before. At least when I say the history of the world, at least since our recorded history, there could be some things that happened before that that are similar to what's going on now.
Okay. We're really running out of time, but give our listeners where we can tell our listeners where they can go to check out more of your work and your books and what have you.
Yes, I think my two latest books are Light at the End of the Tunnel, A Survival Plan for the Human Species, and The Money Mafia, A World in Crisis. They're both good books to read, and they are sort of precursors to my memoirs that I'm working on now and which will be published next September. And they're available from bookstores or from Amazon or from my website, which is paulheatherweb.com. And I think they're good places to start, for unless people are very sophisticated, and even for some of the fairly sophisticated people, they find interesting things in them. So I recommend them, even though I'm not in the business of making a living from selling books. That's right. For sure.
Mr. Hellyer, I want to thank you for joining us, and thank you for your service to the world, over the years.
And well, thank you very much, David. It was good to talk to you, and bless you and your listeners.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. And this show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website. Click on Talk Shows on the homepage, then Tuesday Forum. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, which is ufoimplications.com. That's ufoimplications.com. So please stay tuned to whfr.fm, the station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
Guys and dolls, you are at the malt shop with Daddy G here.